This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Dale Pendell. He's the author of a new book called The Great Bay, Chronicles of the Collapse. It's a novel, and one might call it dystopian, about the future. I think it's a really, really great book and one that I hope a lot of people will read. Hi, Dale. How are you?
Hi, David.
Good to talk to you today. You know, I should mention we've known each other kind of peripherally for a long, long time, probably 35 years, when we were both younger and involved in poetry and bioregional stuff. And
I have a book on my shelves called Sassafras.
And that was my first book. Not a really good one either. But so when I first met you way back, you were living in Northern California, up in the Sierras in a place called Grass Valley. And so maybe you want to talk a little bit about, you know, your background as a writer and what you've done. Then we can start talking about the book.
Well, when I lived in Nevada County in the 70s and early 80s, I lived up on San Juan Ridge and edited a poetry magazine called Kuksu, Journal of Backcountry Writing, which was trying to give a place for, I don't know, back to the land and bioregional authors to find each other, to connect with each other. Then I was away from Nevada County for 20 years, mostly living in Santa Cruz. But now I'm back in a different part of the county, but it's nice to be back in the foothills.
So just for people who may not be aware of the geography, the Sierras where you are, what's the nearest kind of big town that you're east of that would locate you?
Well, vaguely between Sacramento and Reno.
Right.
Yes, or Lake Tahoe.
Yeah. So, and how high up are you?
Well, I'm right in the Oak Chaparral transition zone. We've got ponderosa pines, so I'm at about 2,000 feet. But it's a little montane island, actually. So it feels more like 2,500 feet.
And do you garden or plant?
Well, yeah, a little garden. Little garden. Most of the work is just trying to keep the brush back.
Are you worried about fire a lot?
Oh yeah,
because it's pretty dry up there.
Oh yeah, every year that's the big fear.
Right.
Smelling for smoke all the time.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this book. The novel really is about the unfolding of the future of mankind, the humanity, and the earth itself. And it starts, you know, in the fairly near future, about 2021, I think you have it, and you imagine what you call the Great Collapse. And it comes about, you know, we don't need to go into the details, but I think it's well, you know, kind of well done that you've got this kind of potentially war breaking out, and it's kind of like a biological war, almost like the Cold War between America and China breaking down, and then just by mistake, you know, this inexorable chain of events occurs. And you've got essentially devastation of the entire population worldwide, infrastructure falling apart. And I thought that was pretty powerful, this idea. You know, when people think about the future and how things could go, there's a certain linearity to our thinking. And I think you break through that in the way you have imagined the collapse, that it isn't linear to where we are today. It isn't like things decline or people keep doing what they were doing, but just less. It's pretty calamitous. And then you sort of go off from there, pretty far into the future. And you focus a lot on California, which makes sense because you're a Californian person, but you talk, you know, pretty coherently, I think, about what happens around the rest of the world. But, you know, maybe you want to talk a little bit about the kind of genesis of this, what got you feeling, you know, that you needed to write this book.
Well, I've always thought California was the place where the wounds are so fresh, you know, the blood is scarcely dried. And old California is very close to the surface at a lot of places. So it's not so hard to see what was there before. The chains that hold industrial civilization together are a lot weaker than one might think. It doesn't take a whole lot of a disruption to have disastrous consequences. Water main broke a few.
Right, and also the energy supply. I thought you
could
shoot
the energy
really
supply. Could go down really easily if people don't go back to work, they can't get it. And once it goes down, it's not always so easy to get it back up.
Right, and the other thing that you pictured, and I thought this was really brilliant, was that once these, like when you're in a time of crisis, you don't have the skill sets that people had hundreds or even longer years ago to cope with a non-industrial environment, so that without electricity and without energy in, the system really doesn't work, but people don't have the skills to survive.
They don't have the skills. Skills can be lost and take some generations usually to build up. There's really specific techniques for hunting, spinning, weaving, doing lots of things oneself. For fixing things, it's kind of hard to get something repaired these days.
Things aren't mechanical. Everything is solid state. So the solid state environment does not lend itself to repair. And so you have this, not only do you have, I mean, if you think about it, a couple of hundred years ago, you would have mechanics of all kinds. Mechanics and artisans were really the nature of Jeffersonian America. Small farmers, local repair people, the forgers of iron, people knew how to do that. They knew how to make things out of iron. They knew how to make implements, and they could function in a mechanical world.
And what I found out reading, I read widely in history of technology and particularly the Industrial Revolution in the United States and in the colonies in Connecticut and places like that. Where it was kind of led by watchmakers and watch repairers. But it took a long time. McCormick's Reaper didn't work for, you know, years and years. It took several decades to perfect that until farmers would start to use it. Interchangeable parts. Jefferson started that after a French idea, and it took a huge input of government subsidy for 40 years before they finally were able to produce guns with interchangeable parts that worked, and they still were more expensive, and they weren't as good quality as handcrafted weapons. So if it were left, if it had been left to the invisible hand of the market, it wouldn't have developed. Everything depends on something else being created. You know, you couldn't have had, you had to have glass manufacture before you could make any progress in electricity, because electricity was all done with electrostatics. And it's almost impossible just to quickly bootstrap industry. There's all of this long chain of prerequisites that had been built up over centuries.
Right. So what happens in the collapse, and of course you track it in more detail the closer we are, but you know, you pick certain people and certain areas to illustrate with stories, which I thought was really good. So it's not just a, you know, it's not like a textbook on what will happen. It's really an illustrated, imagined story where you try to kind of guess what will happen over the course of these hundreds and hundreds of years. But I think at the beginning, you know, you've got huge disruption, lots of suffering, lots of death, and then this really important trigger, which is the global climate change pattern really affects humanity in this huge way.
Yeah, and so this book will be called science fiction. We might hope that's true. And the pandemic that reduces the human population so severely, is that utopian or dystopian?
Probably dystopian, unless one prefers a planet populated by, you know, the small number of people, which actually, you know, the planet may, I mean, so much of this, what you posit, does make sense to me, because it is, it's not, no one wants all these millions of people to die, but the Earth is having so much difficulty because of so many people doing so many exploitive and extractive things. You know, because we are unable to organize our society, at least at this point, in a sustainable way, and we show no signs of listening.
No sign of
any ability to listen or to see the future. And that's why I think this book is important, because I think if people can imagine the horror and the terror and the disruption and the death and the misery that occurs through a collapse, that they might be able to say to themselves, enough, we have had enough, we can't do this anymore. And that's why I hope this book is read. I hope people feel like, you know, they have to pass it on to the next person so that you get a glimpse of the future. You know, I know people don't want to see this. I think it's really scary for people. They put the denial system in place. Humans are really good at this, at an ability to ignore anything that they don't want to know, that doesn't fit their current mindset or, you know, their idea of how things should be. And of course, change is really, really difficult. Nobody wants to give up what they have and do something differently because they're comfortable doing what they do.
Yeah, but people might be willing to tithe, you know, that old principle.
Right,
a lot of the problem is not people per se, but kind of automaton-like machines or magical entities such as a corporation, which is not a human entity.
Right.
But is kind of particularly designed and created to extract and chew up resources.
Right.
Both natural and cultural and human.
Right. It's something, corporations are almost by definition subtractive and not additive.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's something that we could do something about very easily. All it takes is the same kind of legal writ that created them to change them and say that they don't live forever. They are not persons protected by the Constitution, and we grant them particular freedom and coverage from liability to do one specific thing. But
right, which is...
That doesn't mean they can enter politics or buy other corporations.
No, in fact, that what you're describing is the nature of corporations in the 18th century, where they were chartered by society to perform certain deeds. And if they didn't perform those deeds, they had to be disbanded. If they failed to meet their requirements that they'd, failed to meet the standards that they laid out for themselves, they had to be disbanded. But they were charters granted. In other words, the right to be a corporation is not inherent. It is granted by the society.
Right.
And that's why that Supreme Court decision is just beyond comprehension and proves, to me anyway, that we live in a corporate society and not in a democracy. But that's another story.
Well, that comes into the Great Bay. Scholars after the collapse, historians thinking about the past, trying to wonder what was this pre-collapse society like, and they think about that. You know, it seems after 100 years, it begins to seem very foreign to the people. You know, it's almost like they were the pre-collapse people were extraterrestrial or something.
I thought that was great. People could not possibly understand how a world could exist the way ours exists today. It's so alien. And of course, I think
so
that
one of the things was to try and show that civilization, the way it's currently structured, is not necessary for a good life. One could also structure a society around thinking that we're in business for our health. I think Gary Snyder said that many years ago. Let's remember that we're in business, that when push comes to shove, we're not in business to make money, we're in business for our health, to make a living.
Right. I know, that's a great, if you actually think about that, the expression, to make a living, is actually beautiful.
Yeah, quite.
But the way it is in our kind of day-to-day use, it becomes pretty diminished in value. And Gary was actually brilliant, I think, in his lifetime about pulling out day-to-day language and providing it back its meaning. I always loved that. And you have, by the way, in the book, in one of the scenes, not long after the collapse, and you have poetry runs throughout. I thought that was really important, too, that poetry is actually, in your book, the really, almost the one constant, the poetic language, the commitment to the oral tradition, and maybe a little bit also the idea of Zen koans and, you know, basic Christian principles, continuing on through time. But you had someone known as the great poet celebrated in death, you know, some years after the collapse. Did you have somebody in mind for that person?
I probably did, yeah.
And do you want to say who it is?
Yeah. Well, I was clearly thinking about Gary, sure.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, because he did. In fact, I think I even mentioned in there the human being.
Right.
Where he,
1967.
Yeah.
There's a lot of California kind of counterculture history in the book because you talk about those communities, working together in principles. And this was also really interesting. I thought that you did a really good job of kind of painting a picture of variegation, that in some places people survived in cooperatives. In other places, people survived in fiefdoms, you know, and not necessarily all that, you know, pleasant. Other places were kind of like Native Americans living on the land. You know, there were just all these different forms of survival and then transmutation over the years. And there was one of the scenes that I thought was just spectacular, and that is this journey across the country from California to Colorado, Boulder, at
a Boulder.
Certain point, this is a couple of hundred years in the future, when they're trying to have a kind of gathering of people, you know, to celebrate what remains of culture and how difficult that journey was. And it felt just like, you know, maybe the 17th century, you know, crossing. It was just...
It's really 19th century. It actually follows the Oregon Trail, the California Trail and the Oregon...
In reverse.
Trail in reverse.
Yeah. I thought it was great. I mean, you did this sort of impressionistic telling of stories as a way of capturing the ethos of each era that you dip into, and I thought that was just brilliant. And
so the most challenging artistic problem was, since I was covering such a huge span of time,
right,
and you know, it was trying to, that there's no central character, so hoping to make you know, the earth and the geography kind of the central character that all the stories kind of link to.
Right, and I think you contrasted that really well, that the language of your description of the physical environment is kind of matter-of-fact and pure and just descriptive. Third person, this is what happened. And you talk about, you know, different parts of the world, particularly, I think, early on, you know, through the first, you know, couple of hundred years or more than a few hundred years, it's a lot of it is about water. And because the ice caps are melted and the sea level is rising and rising, and it's an unstable environment, so you have just water changing the landscape radically. And I just think, you know, you're kind of clear and patient painting of that progression over time was really good. And the other thing you did, I thought, that was, you know, was important, was you talked about the population, because I think that gives people something concrete to kind of measure against. You
mm-hmm.
know, we go from X number of people to a radically different Y number of people in the course of this period of time.
Yeah, but it still seems like the world is full.
Right, which is sort of an interesting idea, you know, that you know, kind of it gets into the question of, you know, what is the right number of people for a given amount of land and an environment, and you can be much lighter on the land than we are and still have it be pretty full. So, you know, that kind of gets the essential difficulty that we face. It's just so many people. And, you know, it's why it's so difficult to figure out how this resolves without some sort of calamity.
Personally, I favor birth control over death control. But
yeah. Well, but we may get to that. I think more people may... have to come to that conclusion that
there are movements that direction. What's not clear is whether it will come in time to save the other large mammals.
Right. Well, you know, we're talking on July 5th in the East Coast right now, one of the hottest periods that we've had, you know, that we have ever had in the summer. You know, I think that clearly climate change has massive effects on mammals, on humans, you know, and on all kinds of beings. And it's it's hard to know. And of course, in the book, you, I think, posit pretty clearly that the tipping point for the changes really has passed. You know, that it's, even if you stopped all...
Even if we stopped carbon emissions now, there's about a 30-year delay to see the effects of what we have right now.
Right.
Kind of the warming we're experiencing now is what happened back in the 70s and 80s.
Right. That's a pretty scary idea.
Uh-huh. And funny, there's a book that just came out, a new book by Peter Ward called The Flooded Earth. And there's sunken buildings on the front, which was the original cover that I designed, actually, looked just a lot like that. And he has little kind of fictional snippets at the end of some of his chapters. But he, you know, he sees the basic governmental corporate machine to keep going. Man, now there's a dystopia.
Yeah.
I mean,
no, I think that it's hard to imagine exactly, excuse me, exactly, you know, how things go. I mean, you know, obviously you have a vision of one way things could go. And there are many other possibilities, but I think the issue is not the specifics of how things go. It's rather more that things are going to go in this direction, and that it's really the real question, the real challenge is how will people adapt, and can they make significant enough changes before things get really, really bad. And I don't know whether we have an answer for that.
Yeah, well, you know, I did a long study. I've I have three books on kind of the history of psychotropic plants and drugs. And the behavior seems to be most like a speed freak. Even heroin junkies often are able to taper off. Not always, you know, some of them use until it's all gone and then they have to kick cold turkey. But sometimes they can say, okay, I've got to quit this. I'm going to cut my dose in half, and then I'll cut it in half again. But, boy, speed freaks, I almost never see that. Nobody's that, you know. It's a binge thing. So they use it until it's gone. And cheap energy is like that. You know, coal, and it's, you know, a barrel of oil is like 10 years of human labor.
Right.
So, yeah, maybe someone will get it together.
Maybe
the Chinese will move to clean up their act, even if the West does not.
Well, the Chinese may, in fact, be able to influence the West.
Yeah.
Because they will have more people and more, literally more power, and they, you know, at this point may own most of the wealth of the world. So... anyway, I hope, you know, what I would hope for is that more people read your book and say, this is a future that we would rather not see happen in quite this way. And
there's some nice stories in there. I mean, the Great Bay is beautiful.
Oh no,
it's blue and it stretches out, and there's catamarans and outriggers.
That's the sort of irony, is that there's just beauty in the book. But there's also, to get there, this incredible amount of suffering and difficulty. But maybe there's a kind of Zen parable there, as you have in the book. You know, it's maybe the it is required that there be all of this noise before there can be silence.
Yeah, in some ways, embracing the apocalypse is maybe an act of weakness. I don't think the apocalypse will save us. It'll just probably be worse than anything I imagined. But my hope was that through the stories, that it, you know, it might help free the imagination. We have to free our imagination from the world as we know it and the structure, because we start thinking that's the way things have to be, and it's not true.
Right. No, so, I think that's a powerful message. I think it's really important. And I want to thank you, Dale, for talking to me today. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Dale Pindell, who's the author of a truly, I think, a really great book called The Great Bay.
So, David, did you like the stories?
I did. I love the story.
I am so glad.
No, I love the book. Everything about this book, I really loved it. It transported me. And I think that's really what I need from a book. So thanks, Dale. I appreciate it.
You bet.